everybody, and welcome to Indie Film Cafe. I'm your host, Jonathan Moody, and I'm here with...
Polly Presents, known as the Moo Cow. Moo!
All right, and we're also with...
Joe Turek.
And today we're going to be doing a movie that I'm really excited about. We're supposed to do it, I guess, a couple months ago, and fortunately, I couldn't find it at the time, of course, because that happens a lot to me.
And it's happened to us before on Indie Film Cafe.
Yeah, so we have to choose something else, and I decided to choose Gamebox 1.0, and we had our buddy Joe for that one, and because he was supposed to be on this one. So we said, you know, would you come back for another one? And actually, Gamebox 1.0 is our best one that, you know.
The lowest scoring movie so far on Indie Film Cafe.
Yeah. Period? Even in season?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's the lowest on the stakeometer.
So I guess I'm here for payback.
I know. Well, I mean, this one is not, and I've seen this movie a million times, especially when I was a kid. This used to be a movie that I would watch all the time. So it's a treasure to go back and watch it. There's actually an international cut of it, and we'll talk about that a little later. But we're going to watch the original real version of it because, you know, that's what I want to, you know, that's what I remember seeing and everything. And after that, we will come back and we'll talk about it. So,
and what is the movie called, sir?
Oh, God. Yes, it's called No Retreat, No Surrender. And if you're watching this, you probably have already seen that title on there. But No Retreat, No Surrender, there's actually, I think, three of them, if I'm correct. But this is the first one and the best one, seriously. So get ready. But before we do that, we're going to do some
mood music.
All right, and we're back.
Yay.
From watching No Retreat, No Surrender.
No Retreat, No Surrender.
If you didn't know that by watching that movie, the title of the movie, then I'm sorry, but they say it three times.
At least.
Yeah. I think it was three times. That's how I counted. But yeah, apparently, I guess the original title was Ring of Truth. Which is a horrible title for a movie about, you know, about fighting and stuff like that or whatever. But, you know.
It's not even a ring. It's a square.
Well, it's supposed to be a ring. I don't know. Whatever. But anyway, it was okay. So let's kind of explain this story a little bit about what it's about. So it's about this guy at a karate dojo. I guess these guys want to move in on his dojo and kind of take it over.
As they do.
And they're going to, basically pay him to, you know, to just go somewhere else or something. They need that property. And instead of saying, sure, I'll move somewhere, he goes, no, I don't want to move anywhere. You guys can't buy me out. And, of course, there's a guy in the 80s, you know, with the cigar who's like, you know, I can do whatever I want. You know, I've got these guys here who'll rough you up. And so one guy tries to fight him, and it doesn't work out. And then Jean-Claude Van Damme kicks his ass. And the guy just decides, you know what, this is, you know, this place is too bad. It's L.A., you know, right?
And it's not just his ass, his son as well.
His son is there, too. So he's like, I don't want anything to happen to neither of us. Let's move to Seattle, where it's, I guess, safer. You know, is the idea. But, you know, what this kind of movie kind of shows is, like, there's fighting everywhere, you know. It's anybody can burst out fighting. So, you know, even though fighting doesn't solve anything, you know, that's what people do in the 80s.
And, of course, Seattle just happens to be where a certain person's favorite, you know, martial artist idol happens to be buried.
Right.
So, of course, that's where they're going to end up going.
Exactly.
Otherwise, it would have been wherever else. If Bruce Lee would have been buried in, say, Oregon, they would have had to go there, I guess.
Right.
Well, and that's good. That's good that they picked that place. Because Seattle, even though they didn't shoot in Seattle much, you only see, little landmarks of Seattle. The rest of it was actually filmed in L.A. And surrounding areas or whatever.
Palm trees and all.
Palm trees and all.
Right.
You actually see palm trees. That's a continuity error. Yeah, there's tons of continuity errors this movie. But anyway, so he goes to Seattle with his the son and the father and the Holy Spirit, his mother, go there, and they are kind of dealing with this, you know, just moving to a new area. It becomes Karate Kid. I mean, they even have a station wagon, from Karate Kid in the movie, I guess, you know, kind of thing. And they move with a U-Haul to Seattle, and he starts setting up all his, the son starts setting up all his stuff in the garage with all the karate gear and everything. And
that's when he meets his new best buddy.
His new best buddy.
The sidekick.
Yes, this guy named RJ, who has a really long name. That's why you call him RJ, like Reginald...
Jones Alexander the Third, right.
And he has these horrible '80s Jerry curls. It's so bad.
It's so awful. So anyway, he, you know, they become best friends like from the second they meet each other,
right.
And everything. And then you also meet the fat guy. I think his name is Scott.
Yeah,
is his character.
So. Yeah,
the fat bully.
The fat bully. And he was just like, you know, he's just your stereotypical fat bully guy. And he ends up kind of telling them, you know, or whatever, kind of getting mad that RJ exists. I don't know why, but...
Well, he doesn't like RJ because the thing about RJ is that he's also a stereotypical 80s black kid in that he can rap and break dance.
I don't think that's why he doesn't like him. I think that might be why you don't like him.
I didn't mind RJ. I just didn't like the fat guy.
Yeah, the fat guy... No, because he says he's got his reasons, but he never... explains his reasons and stuff. So I just think he was a racist.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think he was just a racist guy. And
maybe
that's
he just hates breakdancing.
I don't know. Well, he doesn't really breakdance that much. He only does it once.
Oh, my God.
No, twice.
You have to suffer through it. It's pretty awful.
He does it that one time where he raps and everything and he breakdances. And then he does it again, I guess, in that dance.
On the dance floor.
He dons the whole Michael Jackson getup with the one glove.
Oh, my God. It was so cringeworthy.
I guess that was the, and then the other ones that were right with them had the Thriller jackets,
right?
Get up
right.
on, but
yeah.
I guess that's the time.
Oh, I had to live through that.
And I think he looked just like Michael Jackson, like they were trying to model him after, which I mean, it kind of sucks now.
He airwalked and everything. I mean,
oh yeah,
he had the whole routine down. It was awful. So there's a lot of ripoffs going on in this particular film. So a lot of very familiar tropes.
Also had a little bit of West Side Story thrown in because there was a girl who apparently they explained it. He had met the girl when she visited LA one summer, like last summer or something. And so they, you know, she lives in Seattle. That's a big coincidence that, you know, the girl he liked or whatever also lived in Seattle. This is like pre-internet too. So, I mean, they must have like, he must have sent him a like, or maybe called her or something and told her that he was coming to, you know, live.
Yeah, there's a lot of blanks we have to fill in for exposition.
There is for a little bit. You know, but then there's also exposition that they actually do share.
Right.
And it just feels awkward. Like she has to explain these things because the audience is very confused how these people know each other.
Right.
You know,
and then there's this whole, you know, subplot going on where the local dojo guy's assistant is going after her, and there's now a rivalry for her, even though she's kind of very bland as a girlfriend, frankly.
I don't know. I thought she was very cute. I mean, she might be a bland kind of character in a way, but I don't think so. I think she was just a bland actress, maybe, which wasn't, I mean, I don't know. Like, a lot of these people, as we learned a little bit ago, were like first-time actors.
This was it.
You know, so.
I think in her case, this was the only thing she was in, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's looking the cast up. This is the only thing she was. She was no Elizabeth Shue, if you will, from Karate Kid.
Yeah, she didn't move on to bigger and better things from after this.
Nope.
But the other guy, Kurt, who played the main, you know, main guy, Jason, he's actually gone on and done a few other things.
And of course, let's not forget Ivan / whatever the thing that the title at the end said.
Carl Brezhden,
right?
I think it said.
I mean, they refer to him as Ivan through the whole thing, but it is none other than Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Right.
The one and only.
And he, you know, and he did a wonderful job considering that was like his first big role, you know, in a movie.
And it's, you know, it's a very one-dimensional, I am the most evil, reprehensible villain you can possibly run into. There's nothing good in me, and I'm Gurron, you know, just snarling. And, you know, I guess he's supposed
making
to
faces.
He's supposed to be the stereotypical awful evil Russian villain like you might see in a worldwide wrestling show.
Well, no, or we were talking about it before, Rocky IV had just come out, and there was Ivan the and that might have been the big thing, is like they had another name for him, and so when they were looking at the credits, trying to do the credits, that was the original name in the script, probably.
Possibly.
And then they changed it when Rocky IV came out. They were like, oh, let's give him another name. Let's do Ivan so people
not
recognize
Russian
Ivan.
Enough.
Yeah.
I mean, this was the Reagan 80s, so there you go.
So anyway, so this kid goes and he moves to this new town and unfortunately gets his butt he kicks some butts of the people. Then he gets his butt kicked by the one guy you were talking about that fell in love. The assistant sensei.
Right.
Assistant sensei, which we call assistant Dean because that's his name is Dean or whatever. And he kicks, you know, basically gets what is it? What's his name? Jason, his butt kicked in the kumite in a fight scene or whatever with this guy who's actually a real fighter. Apparently,
yeah.
Sugarfoot was his nickname. This black guy, and he was wonderful in it.
And the thing about Jason is that he gets his ass kicked, and then he becomes a jerk. You know, he even becomes a jerk to the girl, and he just runs off, runs back home, and then he's a jerk to his dad. You know, and so he's pretty much got to move out, and so that's when he runs to RJ, right?
We haven't gotten to that part, but all right, well, I guess skip ahead because it is. I mean, this we're explaining everything, but we're kind of explaining everything,
right,
so
right.
Yeah, I shouldn't have to do that. But yeah, he goes to see RJ, and RJ says, "Move all your." We didn't even get to know. You skipped over the ghost of Bruce Lee.
It's coming to that.
No.
No, the ghost happens.
Oh.
The ghost happens afterwards.
Yeah,
that's true.
Right.
Because
right.
RJ goes back home and then.
Right, right.
Okay.
Moves him into the empty house that RJ happens to know because
he knows
how to get everything pretty much, as a good sidekick does. Gets him into this empty house. He sets up all his stuff. He falls asleep. And all of a sudden, here comes the poorly dubbed ghost of Bruce Lee. And that's really Bruce L.I. or L.E.E.O. or something. Because it guy does not look like the real Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
It's just,
but
he's
he has
an
some,
Asian.
But he had some history with him from being in Game
right,
of Death.
Right, 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 right.
So I guess that's the somewhat linkage. But
he was
probably appearance-wise wasn't...
He was probably a stunt coordinator or a choreographer or somebody who knew it because he could clearly do the moves.
Yeah. He could do the moves. He looked from an angle, you might think, or something. Like, there was some couple shots. It's like, okay, I can see that. But when you see his face, like, full on, you're like, nope.
Right.
That guy does not look anything
nope.
like him. But,
nope,
like, from
nope.
the side angles and stuff, I'm like, all right, that guy could pass for, like, Bruce Lee, you know, or whatever. But from, like, full on angle shot, I'm like, no, that guy looks completely different. But it was great. So he teaches him, and you have a few montage scenes. And RJ even comes and spies on him a couple times and sees like how crazy he is.
Because, of course, he's not really there, and nobody else can see the ghost of Bruce Lee. The mean-spirited ghost of Bruce Lee, by the way. He, like, whacks Jason several times and
smacks
him and says, "You're not thinking. Smack. That's not how you do it. Smack."
There was a great movie that Jonathan Brandis was in called Sidekicks. I don't know if you guys ever saw movie.
With Chuck
Norris. This movie was made before then, so maybe they got the inspiration for the idea of a kid being trained by their idol.
Like a master, yeah.
Yeah, and he happened just to hold only, you know, the difference is he happened to be alive, you know, or whatever. So I think Chuck Norris liked this movie enough, like he, you know, was like, all right, I'll play because, you know, why not, right?
Yeah.
But even you pointed out, like Ghost Bruce Lee gives very contradictory advice. He'd be saying things like, you have to think about what you're doing. You're not thinking about what you're doing. Why aren't you thinking about what you're doing? And then he'd say, you must empty out your mind and not think about what you're doing. And it's like, wait a second. You just smacked me for saying I wasn't thinking.
Oh, he smacks him a lot.
I know.
Man, I kind of felt bad. Like, you could have a drinking game with how many times that the kid gets smacked. Like, drink every time. You'd be drunk.
And I think that one of the things that the themes that they kept, or parts they kept going over is they kept they had to like hit you in the head literally multiple times with the same idea for it to come to get through to
right,
you.
Right, right.
Like they didn't think we could just get it from what we saw.
Oh, right. The right. title.
Yeah, the title three times. The product placement, Coke, I guess.
Oh my goodness, that was so bad.
I think Coke must have funded it.
By the way, you know, I'm drinking cherry Coke right now. Product placement.
Yeah. Coke Zero.
Oh, Coke Zero, right yeah. over there. What do you got?
Diet Coke.
Oh, yeah. We didn't even plan this.
Throw us some money, Coke. Come on.
I mean, you threw it to this No Retreat, No Surrender piece of crap.
Right. We will pimp you out. Come on.
All right. Anyway. And now, back to our regularly scheduled program.
Back to the story.
To get back to the story. So he trains with Bruce Lee, and then I guess he just kind of... goes to the makes up with the girl because he had pushed her once, you know, and they never talk, you know, or whatever, while he's doing all these montages and all these days, you know, pass by. He goes to a breakdancing dance thing, and the girl gets kind of pushed with him to dance or whatever, and then they dance together.
Yeah, she turned from standoffish to accepting pretty much on a dime.
She was very reluctant.
Yeah,
first.
That's true.
They both did. They were both reluctant to dance with each other, and then he goes, "May I have this dance?" And she's like, "I thought you would never ask." I'm like, "What? Like, you guys were just hating each other like 2 minutes ago, and now you guys like all of a sudden, whatever. I don't understand. You know, I don't understand love. Maybe that's it."
Clearly when we got to see the interview after the movie with the lead actor, and he talks about how they were clearly focusing more on the fight scenes and the choreography and the martial arts than they were on anything else in the film. So.
Right, and that, you know, you can kind of tell like the acting and the, but the great thing about that is the acting and the other stuff is really like secondary. Like that is like, I mean, they don't really care. They really spruce up the action and they make it mainly an action movie. Whereas a lot of independent movies and stuff concentrate mainly on the story or whatever and the acting and stuff and less on the action. You know, that's, I like this because there's enough action to keep me interested that I just didn't even care about the story, like really as much, you know. Like if those people got together, great. If they didn't, I wouldn't have cared.
Right.
You know, and they did.
I mean, although a lot of that action is montages, training montages. You see a lot of training montages.
There's a lot of training, and there's a lot of random fight scenes with random people, too. Right. Like, there's a lot of bully fight
right,
scenes.
Right, right. And, like, the father gets bullied because, you know, when they move there, I guess he got himself a job as a bartender at this bar they called the Brig. And the guy, there's a bully there who keeps, you know, he wants a beer. He's like, "No, you got to walk it over to me." And then he's... starts shitting all over him, basically, before the guy finally throws him out. And then later on, that turns into yet another fight scene when the movie starts lagging. He's like, "Well, we got to throw in an action scene, so let's have the bully show up again with four of his buddies." You know,
he did say, "I'll be back, and you'll be sorry."
Right.
Kind of thing. So, I mean, it did set it up where you knew that guy was probably going to show back up because when you say that line, you know, have
you
a
better show up.
You better show up, otherwise, like, what happened? Why? That line didn't make any sense.
And we have seen plenty of movies where that exactly happens.
Right. So we don't want that. You know, we would rather, you know, have a scene where the guy comes
right.
back.
And, of course, this time, now the son has become the master because the son ends up bailing out the father who is getting his butt kicked because, you know, he got his leg broke by Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why Jason, I mean, they had to put that scene in there for Jason to have a fight scene outside of the climax.
Right, and it's right after he finally got trained.
Yeah.
So it's a chance to show off his stuff.
It's a chance to show off his stuff, and it's a chance to show off to his dad that sometimes, and he says it, he says the line, sometimes fighting is, sometimes you have to fight, you know.
Right.
And then the father says, "I'm proud of you." And I'm like, what? Yeah. You know, like... you're proud that your son just kicked a bunch of old men's asses, you know? Like, why why are you, like, you were so adamant about not fighting that you don't, and that's the thing, like, people change
On the dime.
On a dime. Like, the girl, you know, changed. He changed. Everybody just... It's because, like, it just felt like this movie sometimes went too quickly. Right. You know,
it was very
whatever.
Contrived.
Like, there's no... You know, there's nothing enough to, like... You know, there's enough space at times to kind of do things because there's too much going on.
Right, it's really the writing's fault, and yeah. that's what's going on.
Maybe it should have been a longer movie. Technically, you know, I'm glad it wasn't. I'm just saying that I think it should have been.
Joe, didn't you say the original script was something like 2 hours and 20 minutes long?
Yeah, it was like 220 pages or something. I was reading in one site. No, if that's true, and then he was like revising every night on set and stuff like that. So. It seems like there's I think they tried to say a lot more was going on than really, they tried to trim it down, but at the same time it was kind of choppy. But to Jonathan's point, it was mainly just to get to the action because that's where they really focused.
Right. And
shows.
I thought it was interesting in the interview later on where he says how the writer was on set the entire time and that he not only was he there as the writer. But because the director and the crew were Chinese from Hong Kong and they didn't really speak English, he was also acting as interpreter to the actors and saying, okay, here's what they want to do.
Also, I thought it was very interesting that the in the interview, and this you can find this on the, was the Kino Lorber Blu-ray, but there's this great interview, 17 minutes
it's
long.
Really good.
It is, with the main star, Kurt McKinney, and how he basically became part of this film. But he talked about how he was, that the writer was on set, and the biggest thing with the writer was the dialogue had to be set. Like, so we were kind of joking about that because we... because some of the dialogue in this movie is so bad. And you could tell, like, the writer wanted that line in there.
But
you know?
He did have a couple of really good lines.
He did.
You know, the one guy, Sugarfoot, where he's like, I'm nobody's lunch. Yeah. I love that. That's like the great t-shirt line there.
And he had one really bad line that I love to death, which is, Jean-Claude Van Damme goes, so, it is you, the son. Is it not? And then he says something along the lines of...
yes, but it'll be different this time.
It'll be different this time. Russian!
and when he says Russian, that is like sort of like in Back to the Future when they called Marty chicken. It was like the trigger point with... I guess Van Damme lost a sense of reason that he would have as a fighter, and he was just like nonsense, just attack.
Yeah, he was just like... Rawr!
The snarl. Yeah. He had the Rocky snarl.
And, of course, being the villain that he is, he doesn't just fight him in a normal, you know, even kickboxing way. You know, he starts to take chains and part of the turnbuckles. And, you know, he cheats, basically. He cheats the entire time.
All right, so let's get to that real quick because that is part of the end of the story, you know, or whatever. We didn't get to that part is that basically there's these people who are, the Seattle competitors are kind of doing the LA or New York guys. Mm. New York guys come to Seattle to fight. And then it's never really fully established about it, but apparently there was some kind of deal made that Jean-Claude Van Damme could basically come in and challenge everybody instead of the New York guys, right?
Right.
So, but there's like a talk about it, but it's like, so, like, cryptic, you know, you don't understand what's going on.
And, like,
on.
The evil Kingpin and his group are there to watch, and they're there to fix it. And the guy keeps saying, everything is fixed! And he says it nice and loud so everybody hears him.
Yeah, but I don't understand, like, then what was the point? Like, what is the point of winning this competition with Jean-Claude Van Damme?
Well, I think they said it was an exhibition, but at the same time, there was... I mean, I guess they were wanting to take over dojos up there, maybe. I don't know.
I don't know. Remember, they want the fights happening. They don't care about the non-fighting stuff.
And I'm sure that there may be some throwaway line somewhere in there that might explain that. And definitely interested to hear if anybody has anything to say about that. But
yeah.
Well, there's commentary on this too, right?
There is a commentary.
We should watch with the commentary on there, and possibly will be illuminating.
Yeah, sometime we'll definitely have to listen to that because I think it was from the screenwriter. So if he was on set for the whole time and he was there, like, he knows all the ins and outs of this movie and what happened with it.
And probably in the original script, there was an easy, obvious way of explaining what happened, but it just didn't make it into the final cut.
Yeah, definitely.
Or we just missed it because of the brilliant everything else going on.
Well, you know, as soon as Jean-Claude starts to do his famous splits, you know, that's what everybody's going to be looking at.
Yeah, I believe that's the first time he did the splits, because this being his first major, I guess, role. But the first time you get to see him do his signature splits and so, twirl from that.
Yeah. So the Russian is kind of brought up there to fight the three Kingswood kids. That's where they're from in Seattle, I guess, or something. I don't know, part of Seattle or whatever. So they got to fight these guys, and the guys, one by one, start with the Dean guy, who's kind of obnoxious, kind of brat. You kind of want him to get his butt kicked.
Yeah, kind of rooting
for Jean-Claude Van Damme to kick that dude's ass. And he does, and he kicks, you know, that dude's ass, like knocks him out of the ring, and he's disqualified or whatever. So next, they bring in the black guy, Sugarfoot, who apparently, from what I heard in the interview, was that that he actually got hurt on when they were doing the fight
scene.
Right. Or something. So
knocked out once or twice.
Yeah, and by accident from Jean-Claude Van Damme. And Van Damme is very much known for this as being like, sometimes he gets overzealous when he does the fights and stuff and actually ends up, you know, hurting the people. It was Cyborg had that issue where he actually, hit the, I think poked the guy in the eye or something.
Yeah, there was like legal stuff, I think, that happened from this and Cyborg. So, I mean, there was questions around stuff that happened on set and stuff like that. But I believe everything turned out that he, and a lot of people actually speak up for him saying he's really safe to fight or it's choreographed well.
Yeah, and then they had the incident where the lead guy in his interview talks about how he had that blood capsule in his mouth, remember? And he knew about it, and then the makeup guy knew about it, but nobody else knew about it. So when he got hit in that scene, that one fight scene, and he bit down on it, and the fake blood came out of his mouth, freaked out. He just like totally freaked out because he thought he really hurt him.
Right. Yeah, definitely. So I think that's a really funny funny little bit that he did with that, because that was I guess that was like a little prank that he pulled. But anyway, so you know, they fight what's his name, the next guy, the Sugarfoot guy, gets to fight, and he goes up there and he gets his ass whooped too, by Jean-Claude Van Damme, of course. And then after that, he did a really good job. I mean, the fight scenes were really cool. Like you actually thought they were really fighting, and they probably were a little bit.
Poor sucker got knocked out. They had to carry his body out.
He had to carry his body out.
Yeah, there was no medical practice. Correct ways of taking him out of the ring. They just basically took him out like it was just
sack of meat.
Yeah, poor guy. So then he was like, "I'm the best. I am the best." And so he fights. He fights the champion, and the champion starts kicking his ass, and he doesn't like that, you know. So he starts fighting dirty and doing all the bad stuff. And then, the sister of the best guy or whatever goes to like knock him out or something with a chair, which I was like, what is she doing?
It was turning into wrestling.
Basically. It was turning into wrestling.
And don't forget the fat bully. He goes up to bite him.
Bites him and Jean-Claude Van Damme headbutts him.
That was funny. I think everybody loved that. That's like the moment that everyone was like, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, nobody liked Jean-Claude Van Damme, but also nobody liked the fat bully either.
Yeah. So either way, like, you know, whatever. But anyway, so he goes up there and, the girl comes to, like, hit him with a chair or whatever, a stool, a bar stool or something. And that's when our hero, Jason, runs up and basically fights him.
Right.
And they have their final showdown and he beats the guy, you know, But, I mean, at one point you weren't sure if what was going to happen, and then of course he wins.
But he had to cheat again. I mean, that was the thing, is he had to cheat, and I think he hits him with something, that piece like, of the ring. And
to his eyeballs.
Right. So it's like, that's kind of like admitting that you're not good enough in order to fight and beat him in a regular fight, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. So then he does still win because he uses all the tools that you know, you learn, and you see these in like little flashes of like
lots
what he
of
was
flashbacks.
Doing. What, yeah, a lot of flashbacks of how he learned all these things, and all of a sudden he knows what he has to do, and he does the final kick thing that Bruce Lee taught him, and and stuff like that. That was so cool. Like even if it was obviously fake and it, like it would never have happened, you know. It was still pretty cool.
And then at the end, the final shot is everybody's on this in the rink and just like lifting him up in the air, going "Yay!"
Because
now he's finally like been accepted by everybody, and everybody likes him because really nobody liked him at all throughout the whole movie,
except for RJ.
Yeah, except for RJ. So.
Yeah.
Before we go into anything else, I wanted to remind everybody, if you guys really like what we're talking about right now, please subscribe to us on Podbean. Also, check us out on, Indie Film Cafe, or at Indie Film Cafe at Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Also, check us out on indiefilmcafe.reviews. And check our stuff out. We will have our scoreboards and other things, and you'll be updating more of that stuff.
And don't forget our Patreon.
Patreon, where you can support us. Just $1 helps us out a lot. So
absolutely.
We really appreciate that. Just $1 a month could really use, you know, could help us with gas money and paying for this thing and everything.
Someone's
like
got to buy the champagne. That lady here is slurping down like a bottle a minute here.
Yeah, our we've got our dog here too, our little mascot here, lady, and she's a little rascal today. She's trying to come up here and hang out with us.
Yay! Come on, there you go.
All right,
good girl.
Yep. Sorry, she's kind of distracting us.
So one of the things that I found interesting when we watched the little documentary thing afterwards, the conversation with the actor was. Usually it's like money or whatever is the reason why they don't, the actors and stuff like that aren't in part two, but there's actually a quite interesting story
in
the documentary
goodness.
Of why
that was awesome.
Why himself and Jean-Claude, for that matter, was not going to have any part of a part two to this.
Right, and the first part, I mean, I think it was going to be a direct sequel, right? Like it was going to be No Retreat, No Surrender 2. It was going to actually involve Jason, and then I think when they bailed out. They just changed the script a little bit, so it's a completely different movie. But go ahead and explain.
It seems like there was, I guess it was in Cambodia or something where they were going to be shooting near the
on the border,
near
yeah.
the borders where it's not there's not a very safe area.
Pirates
and various other things. So this is according to the one who played Jason that he was. He was basically told that his new wife would probably not be welcome there because blonde hair and all that, I guess.
Blue eyes.
Yeah, so she wouldn't fit into that. And
I think she was going to be kidnapped by the pirates.
Yeah,
right.
And there was various other things that he was getting the runaround from. It didn't even seem like it was the studio. They weren't even talking to his managers, this, that, and the other. So he just decided to call Jean-Claude. And according to... the one who played Jason, it didn't seem like Jean-Claude was like, there's no way I'm going to do this. And this is before Jean-Claude was really big. I mean, this is soon before Bloodsport, I guess, right around that time period. So he was just getting ready to take off. But Jean-Claude said no, according to him. So I guess that's why they...
I know going!
And,
yeah, he said, because he goes, you know, Kurt, who told you to call me?
Right.
You know, right? Like... No, I know going.
I know going.
And then he said,
"The pirates there. They come. They take our stuff. They take our passports. No one know who we are. They throw us in jail. They fuck us in the ass. I know going."
That fuck us in the ass part was the best part.
Oh my god,
that was great. Yeah,
so they went obviously in an entirely different direction.
Cynthia Rothrock, and he mentioned something about how she was involved in the Hong Kong Mafia and couldn't get out of her contract for this film. And I'm like, holy shit.
So like I said, this is according to his story. So, I mean, I don't know what the truth to all this is and really if there's a lot more to it, who knows. It was just, it's a very interesting take why they went a whole different direction or why some people believe they went
And that's why I love these kind of interviews, because you get all these juicy nuggets and details and stuff that nobody's going to know except for the people who were directly involved, you know? So thank you, Keener Lorber, for adding this great interview there. And I haven't heard the commentary. I don't know if you've heard the commentary yet.
No, not yet.
But I am sure there's all kinds of interesting nuggets of information there, too. So if you're kind of a big fan of this movie, I know you were, Jonathan, I'm sure you'll find all kinds of interesting information.
I listened to the commentary for a second, but didn't really go into, didn't go into the whole thing.
Right.
So I kind of wish I had, but we had, like I said, we had a... I couldn't find it for a little bit, right? And so then when I did find it, I wanted to bring it to the studio and keep it here.
Right.
So I didn't want to have it, to watch it at my house or whatever, because I just wanted to make sure we could do the show.
And just for a second, I do want to bring up one little thing that I've noticed in that, commentary is great for films, especially if you're, if you're going to be watching a movie that you love or you've seen many times and want to get more information about. But there's kind of an art to it. Not all commentaries are equally good. I mean, we've seen some pretty bad commentaries done on some movies.
Just some are boring.
Some are just terrible, and they don't really offer anything, where others are just fascinating and give you all sorts of great nuggets of info that you never knew.
Yeah, and if a director just didn't like the project or whatever, they're not going to talk.
Right.
And they're not going to be able to talk, freely about why they didn't like it, so they have to basically... pretend like they enjoyed working on it or something.
You get the feeling some of these are like contractual obligations that they're fulfilling.
Yeah.
And they're just...
And which I don't think they should be doing commentary if that's the case. Because, commentary should be, fun and enjoyable and stuff.
Get one of the actors or a producer or somebody else who actually, could give you information but had a good time is not obligated.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's why I think this one could be interesting because... it was the writer, I believe, who's done the commentary on it.
Right.
So hearing what he said could be interesting, but like you said, it could become just bland. But it'd be interesting.
Well, it is, because of the whole odyssey from the 220-page Ring of Truth to what we saw in the film. And, of course, the other thing is that, which is on the Keener Lorber cut, is that there's a European cut as well, which is, I guess, has more details in it.
So, about 10 more minutes.
That might explain the motivation, what they were trying, the mafia or whatever was trying to take over the karate world, the dojo world.
I'm sure there's all kinds of other information. I think you said that you didn't care for some of the stuff, though.
Well, okay, yeah. The stuff I saw in the beginning was more about the father, and, you see him at the hospital after he gets, and things like that. You just don't need that. You don't need that added.
Dragged it down, maybe.
Kind of, it's a kind of depressing, or whatever.
It's a downer, man.
Yeah, it's a downer. And so it was more fun to kind of see them go from the dojo to the car, or whatever. Because you understood that that's, you can follow that. It's not hard to, you don't need an extra thing to kind of bring it, it just kind of brings the movie down a little bit, but and there's might be other stuff. I didn't watch the whole thing, and I don't really remember what other than that part. I didn't remember anything else. So.
Well, the commentary would be interesting in another way too, because in addition to knowing what the original story was versus what was actually shot, again, the writer acted as interpreter between the director and crew and then the actors. And so he really got to be involved all the way down into the weeds with how the movie was made on a day-to-day basis. And I think he said something like it took 7 weeks to do all this. So he was probably interpreting and doing all that for the entire time. So he probably saw everything that went on. What I mean? So he probably has some very interesting stories, whether he chooses to share them with the rest of us or not, I don't know.
Yeah, but there might be stuff he obviously can't talk about.
Right.
But I was surprised that the main guy talked about it in the interviews, because there's some things like that, that the Hong Kong Mafia and Cynthia Rothrock, that was something
that was
a
juicy bit
cow
of detail.
I know, and so it was definitely worth watching this interview just for even that, because some of the stuff he talked about how he got into acting and things that was kind of interesting, but kind of you kind of hear these kind of things, stories.
He was the last person to get there for the audition or whatever,
and he went for the lead, and he had never acted in anything before, and he got it. That gives people hope that are actors that are starting out, then go for the lead. You may not get it, but you may be They may think you're perfect for something else.
Right, and he himself even wasn't even convinced that he should go. He had done like a couple of Burger King commercials, and you know, somebody said he should try out for this. He had sent them in his picture and his resume, and they didn't call him. So when the day came, he was like, ah, I shouldn't even bother to go in, but what the hell.
Yeah, technically, if you're not even on the thing, you know, like, you shouldn't be going in. But
right. It was an open call, so.
Yeah, so there you go. So.
But, you know, why not? And so he had nothing to lose. So you show up, and then you see what happens, and that's what happened. So, and then this guy, you said he's gone on to do more things. I think you said something about he was in a soap opera.
Yeah, I think he's been in a couple soap operas in the last handful of years, I believe. I don't know if it's anything major. I didn't look at the entire list of stuff, but this is the only thing I really recall him personally seeing him in.
Right.
But never know when you look through somebody's IMD, and it's like all of a sudden it's like, oh, they're in this.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I know.
So, I mean, that...
Well... And I like the fact that he sort of explains that, you know, this was his first picture and this is Jean-Claude Van Damme's first picture. And they were very, very different, though. He was, you know, an actor who also did martial arts. But Jean-Claude Van Damme, on the other hand, knew exactly what he wanted. He wanted to be a martial arts action star.
And he became that.
Right, and became that versus, say, an actor who's going to do soap operas. I mean, I can't see Jean-Claude Van Damme on a soap opera.
I saw him on Friends.
Really?
Playing himself.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
It was, you know, it's great. It's like, because, okay, so the main reason I picked this movie, not just because it was on Riff Tracks, which we talked about earlier, that is, you know, this is one of the few movies that you're going to see that Riff Tracks does that we do. We don't typically do it. We kind of like to be the ones that Riff Tracks won't even do.
Right.
However, there is, you know, there are going to be a few. There was Birdemic last year, The Room not The Room.
We haven't done The Room yet.
We haven't done The Room yet. I don't even know if we ever will, just because that's just too...
At some point.
That's too popular.
Yeah, but it's...
I'd rather do Big Shock.
At some point, yeah. We'll do that at some point. But at some point, we'll probably do The Room.
Yeah, or some way or another, we'll do The Room. But yeah, so that's what I basically... We were, you know, thinking about that. And I was like... No Retreat, No Surrender is definitely a bad movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is not. It's not a good movie. However, is it really Indie Film Cafe type? And then when I watched the Riff Tracks, I was like, yes. Definitely. It is. It's got so many bad lines. Or, like, there were some lines in it that were just so awful that it almost made us cringe a couple times. Like what RJ says something weird.
He says something weird and cringeworthy the entire movie.
Yeah. RJ has all those. And then, I know the fat guy says a couple like obnoxious things that are just like, what the hell are you talking
Lard
about?
Lard ass.
Yeah. But, you know, it has those moments, and I always thought it was a good movie when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I watched it, and I was like, oh, my God, this is great, you know, right? I didn't know what a good movie was, I guess, back then, because watching it now, I'm like, ooh, good. If I had watched this now, I would have been like, ooh.
But, you know, it is full of 80s tropes, you know. It's got the older guys passing for teenagers. It's got the cheesy survivor-like movie music. It's got the montage. It's got horrible hair and horrible... clothes.
Wallpaper.
Oh my God, the wallpaper and the bric-a-brac.
Yeah, and the wood paneling.
The weird Tomcat poster that was in the background.
Was it Tomcat or Tomcat?
Tomcat. You know, I notice weird things like that.
Yeah, it's so strange. Oh, it was such a...
RJ wearing the Playboy bunny shirt.
Right.
It's interesting. Very, very dated.
Yeah, the girls with the 80s hair and the 80s makeup.
Oh, God, I just realized that. She slaps the guy, just like in Karate Kid.
Right, right.
When that guy kissed Elizabeth Shue.
Yeah, when Johnny did.
Right.
You know, Johnny kissed Elizabeth Shue, and but she slaps him. Oh, my God. Right. It's so such it's a Karate Kid ripoff.
Clearly they saw this and said there's an opportunity to make some money off of this.
I know.
With a slightly older... you know, character and slightly older audience.
I don't know, though. Ralph Macchio was actually pretty old when he played...
Oh, he was. He just didn't look it, though. His character wasn't, you know, I don't think. He's a high school kid.
I know, but this guy is supposed to be in high school. He's supposed to be, like, 17 years old.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. He doesn't really look it, though.
I'm just saying. Yeah. They said that in the thing. It's like, in the interview, they said, what the guy says... You know, the security guard is like, I think he's supposed to be a 17-year-old. Yeah, well, let me go in there and and doing, and I'm glad he did. I mean, I don't know who they would have cast if they didn't find him. But...
Cynthia Rock. There you go.
it would have been a lesbian affair.
One of the things
there.
You mentioned earlier, and I think it makes you have to revisit movies years later and stuff, is what movies did you watch as a kid and really enjoyed as a kid? And then you look back at it after you've been through a lot of life's trials and just maturing and just different things, education, all those different things that life brings forward to you. And then you go back and you watch some of the movies that you loved and you're like, what was I thinking?
Dude,
that's
this
a
was
good question.
33 years for me.
I know, but this is a good question for the audience. If you're out there and you listen to this podcast, please tweet at us at Indie Film Cafe and tell us your stories. What is the movie? I might even post that on the a thing and have a you know, for you guys to answer this question. But what is a movie that you guys watch years later and they're like, oh man, this is terrible?
Right, it's like sort of an embarrassment.
Yeah.
I really liked this movie 30 years ago. Oh my God.
I know. This is that for me for sure. Airborne was that last season because that was atrociously bad as well. But I loved it and people still love it. I think people still love this movie today, but it is just so bad. It is terrible.
You know, it's just very, very cheesy.
Yeah, and it's cheesy, and the dialogue feels weird at times.
Mm-hmm.
I feel bad that the writer who corresponded with the director and everything wanted everybody to keep with that dialogue because, like, some of it is just like, okay, like, all right.
Yeah, TJ or RJ says a number of things, and we're both like, what?
What
the heck
do
you mean?
Like, it was the scene where he was signing up for the karate class, and then he said, do you need help spelling your name?
Oh, yeah, and it didn't seem to make, because what his name was Stillwell or something like
right.
that. And I think they only spent like 10 seconds on that before the assistant was there, and it's like, okay, let's go. And it's like they rushed him into the fight. It was like, it was just
yeah, you didn't even have time to like fill
and
out the application.
It's weird. He follows him into the dojo. Follows him into where he talks to the guy to sign the papers. Follows him into the place to change, and then follows him back outside. It's like, God, well, you're like this little dog.
Yeah.
It's just really weird.
RJ did help him find the place.
That's
or
true,
whatever.
But all you have to do is give him the address.
I know, but he wanted to. It's you know,
he's
he
a
wanted
sidekick.
To be
a,
yeah,
he's,
yeah, he just sort of appeared as needed for the story development.
Right.
I guess so. It was nothing. I mean, even when
he's
just
a contrivance.
Yeah, because it's like when Jason went there and just knocked on his gate, and then, like he just appeared over the gate, like it was like from like Home Improvement
the,
or something
right,
like
right.
that.
The little,
right.
With the little thing on his head.
Oh yeah, he had the little. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a contrivance, just like the girlfriend is obviously a contrivance. It's the romantic interest because you got to have that to bring in the teenagers.
Yeah.
It's just
there.
And then, of course, the nagging mom is another contrivance,
What is silly. That? What is that thing on his head?
Oh, it's like a shower cap because he's got those damn Jerry curls in.
Yeah.
And it's just dripping goo everywhere.
Yeah, it's just, oh my God. Ugh. Anyway, let's talk. We talked a lot about the acting before,
right.
But let's talk about some more. The acting was, for these are first-time actors, so we got to give them some credit that they weren't...
Sure.
They weren't so cringeworthy that everything was, like, hard to watch or something, or
right.
whatever. But the girl, the girlfriend, she was probably the worst. And I'm not saying... She's adorable, by the way. She's just flat out, like, I can see why they hired her as like, eye candy, basically. But they should have gave her less dialogue.
Well, more rehearsals. Clearly, they spent the bulk of the rehearsal period on all the martial arts stuff.
Well, I think that's a tricky thing, the whole balance of it, because if you have first-time actors, it was a first-time screenwriter, it was a director who didn't speak English, to my understanding, so there's no way for stuff to be connected, and maybe the first actor, first time acting, they weren't given the opportunity to change any of the lines because the writer was so strong.
Well,
that makes it a very
well. Plus
hard.
The two, he the guy, the actor, also in his interview afterwards talks about how the crew and the director came over from Hong Kong and they were shooting it in Hong Kong style, which is, you know, the actors are just basically pieces of furniture, and they work you to death. And clearly, I mean, it's a very different approach to filmmaking that they do in the United States with SAG, because this was a non-union film. And so I'm sure as it was a pretty eye-opening experience to some of these first-time actors who kind of make assumptions that this will be, oh, I just come in and say a few lines and that's about it. No, no, no. They probably worked your ass 12 to 14 hours a day, you know, because that's what they do. That's how they churned out all those chop sucky movies out of Hong Kong, you know, and the Yuen brothers and that whole group of people making all those movies in the 70s and 80s. You know, that's how they were very, very successful. It's the same kind of a thing here. And it's just interesting to me how they ended up going off to Thailand and Cambodia to do the second one, you know. And I can understand how some of the folks in this cast would be very reticent about going overseas under those conditions, you know? Goodness.
He didn't go back for the sequel, and neither did Jean-Claude Van Damme. And then, like I said, I think it just became a different movie altogether for a sequel because... I do want to go back. The acting, as far as, like, with the girl and some of the other actors... I feel that's it's horrible that that they had this experience because they probably since they didn't know any better, they probably thought this was how movies are run, right. You know, or whatever. And you don't get much time, you get worked to death, you get treated kind of like cattle, you know, or whatever, and you know, all this stuff, and you probably get a lot of coke, you know,
of different kinds.
Yeah, but
this director has gone on to make some more mainstream films over the years. I mean, doing a few of the Jet Li films, and I mean, even I think he directed The Transporter with Jason Statham. So, he has gone on to do some.
Yeah, and clearly he's somebody who knows the business and who has spent time in the Hong Kong industry and probably did all kinds of, you know, earlier stuff, maybe coordination or stunts or something, and worked his way up, and now he was a director and was able to transition to running pictures and doing things the way he wanted to have things done. So that's good. Yeah. It was a good stepping stone for him. But to go back to your point about the actors, you're right. A lot of these actors probably didn't quite experience the picture the way that they were expecting it, and probably didn't since.
And probably quit because of the experience working on this, you know, and not getting, you know, because I don't think anybody was banging on that girl's door saying, we want you in our next movie because we saw you in No Regime, No Surrender.
Although the lead was really cool about it because he talked about how he was, you know, he didn't know how to do a lot of stuff. So they would say, okay, well, we'll teach you. We'll show you how to do it. And they would just work with him until he got it. So he was able to do stuff. And then, of course, the really fun thing is that, you know, he's talking about how, you know, since he was in so many of the scenes, he was there pretty much the entire 7 weeks, and they had him in a nice trailer. And I'm like, that's got to be nice. You're going from a Burger King commercial to lead in an independent film, and you got your own trailer?
Yeah.
I want my own trailer.
I know, we both looked at each other and were like, we want our own trailer. Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, get us a trailer for Indie Film Cafe.
Damn
Jesus.
Right. I want a bowl of M&Ms with just red M&Ms.
Not just any trailer. You could have a trailer. And I mean,
yeah.
I
period.
Know. Yeah.
Yeah. Like.
Sweet.
And that's freaking awesome.
But I mean, and we're also thinking of this through today's lens. So it's like, I mean, we have like information available at our fingertips, stuff like that. I mean, I'm thinking 30 some years ago when they did this, it was a whole different world.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean, apparently a bunch of novices who had not had experience on sets and stuff like that. So they probably. I mean, they might not have known any better.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's just, it was what it was. And it's just really interesting to see stuff in a different time. And sometimes documentaries on older stuff can make you see it because it takes away all the technology, if you will.
Yeah.
Sure.
Definitely.
And it's interesting, too, because this is a film that really doesn't have much by way of special effects, but it's a lot of choreography. And for the most part, I thought the fight choreography was pretty good. You know, I mean, it looked pretty good. We've all seen movies where they're doing fight scenes and it just doesn't look convincing at all. It just looks really bad. At least at this particular film, they got that part right.
Well, I mean, they concentrated mainly on that.
Right.
So, I mean, they wanted, if anything, people to go out of the movie saying this was a fun action movie,
right.
not this was a, you know, because it could have been half and half, right? And if they had done that, I think the movie would have sucked, because they wouldn't have had time to work on the actors much more. And, you know, and they were first timers. So they really were like, okay, we got first timers here. Let's concentrate on the acting or sure. the fight choreography. Then not and less on the acting. And if the acting suffers from it, who cares? Because people are going to be watching it for the action, not for the for the story.
Right. And I think the action, combine that with it, I mean, obviously having Jean-Claude, I mean, one of his early roles, even though he's only in it for maybe 10 minutes screen time, yeah. if that, maybe right around. Those sort of things, it makes it why it maybe has somewhat of a cult following over the years and why it's still being talked about and why it even came up as an idea for this discussion.
And he's so young looking. He looked really good too back then. I mean, you could see why, you know, he would be, you know, lead man material, even if it wasn't a martial arts film, but obviously that's exactly where he wanted to go.
Yeah, he had I was kind of saying when we were watching it, he had these huge muscles as opposed to the other guy, and the other guy was kicking his ass, and I'm like, oh my god, like, literally, Jean-Claude Van Damme would kill this guy.
Wasn't that his nickname, though, the muscles from Brussels?
Yes, the muscles from Brussels.
And I think that's part of the some of the reason why I was asked to be on this discussion is I've talked about with Jonathan my enjoyment of Van Damme films, and my wife, she kind of jokes at me because she's just like, oh, you just like that, and you just love the Van Damme stuff. And a lot of it is kind of, can get cheesy and stuff like that, or can be bad. But there are some of it that's good. And I mean, he went on to do some really good mainstream stuff in the 90s. And to this day, he still does a lot of stuff. A lot of it is lesser budgeted films, but he has done a few things that have been really good. He has done that. I mean, he did the Prime TV show, which was really good. He did a movie that came out about 10 years ago, JCVD, which I absolutely loved. Mm-hmm. There's a sequence in there where he breaks screen and talks for 10 minutes. And if for nothing else, people watch that, you could see him. He can do acting if given the right stuff. Now he's a bit aged, so it would be a little bit different.
But of course, you got to have the reason why he's in there in the first place, because there's a scene when he's towards the end where he's fighting and he gets really pissed off. So what does he do? He tears his shirt off for no real reason other than to show off his pecs and muscles.
And he gives his little snarl.
Yeah.
You know, he did it. I mean, they did it because they knew that that's what the audience wanted. Because there's going to be, like, you know, there are going to be women there and people are going to want to see that. They're going to want to see his body and everything. And people, you know, people were impressed by him for years.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. So.
I guess the continuity monkey just made an appearance, and there was probably a few reasons for that to show up during this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the palm trees in the Seattle background, and, you know.
You noticed the leg rope sequence when he was training with the ghost. And also, the ghost, he was able to... I guess he can actually physically touch him.
That was just a dumb thing that was annoying to me, because it wasn't really like, then are you really a ghost? Like, what is this thing? Because if he could actually touch him and like hit him and stuff and make him feel pain, then he's not really a ghost, I don't think. I don't know. Or it looks like he's a figment of his imagination, right? Kind of thing. Like,
yeah, because RJ couldn't see him.
Yeah, RJ couldn't see him.
And it doesn't really come up later on. Like, so now that you're a crazy person who talks to ghosts, what's going to happen now?
Right. There's no talk about it. It's just like accepting that he's just a crazy person.
And you accepted it when you first saw it, right? Like, you didn't question it.
But I was like 8, you know, and stuff. I think I wouldn't have questioned anything. I just wanted to see fight scenes and
cool
stuff.
Fight scenes.
Yeah, and that they delivered on that.
Right.
Like, that's the whole point. But the thing with like the ropes, the was the training scene. There was a continuity error where he had like tied it up on his foot, and then in the next shot it was up. You know, or whatever, which was weird because then he put it back down again when he was trying to do it. You know, like it was like they didn't watch that. They didn't see that was.
And like the poster being ripped in a different place and just goofy little things.
Yeah. So there was a few continuity errors, but that's kind of to be expected with a movie like this, where they're mainly, like we said, they're mainly concentrating on the fight scenes,
on the choreography, and I would think a lot of it too is the safety of the people there too, because you know, the fight scenes and the stunts are pretty, you know, fairly impressive. I mean, there are people flying around all over the place out there.
Yeah.
So I imagine there were probably, there may have been a few injuries on this. I'd love to do a little search on the history of this film.
We had heard that kind of like Jean-Claude Van Damme had hurt whatever that one guy, Sugarfoot. Yeah, and it hit him.
Once or twice.
What?
He knocked him out.
Knocked him out, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
I believe that's what I read somewhere.
It was an accident and stuff on the set, and there was like a legal issue with it too or something, you know, or whatever. So there was like a couple little things with that, so.
And it makes you think, because then you think, you know, Bruce Lee's son, you know, with that whole tragic thing, what happens with him in a movie was an accident.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and that's, you just never know what these kind of movies, even if it's a scene where a guy is supposed to punch somebody and they're supposed to miss, basically.
Right.
You know, but it's supposed to look like they got hit, you know. Sometimes they get hit, you know, and you just gotta be careful. But so we are to the end. So let's
time to give the scores. Right. Sticky Movie Scoreboard. So once again, this is the point where we rate the movie on a 1 to 10 basis, with 1 being less stink and 10 being the stinkiest of all. So, and you can give every number in between, including half steps. And Joe, since you are our guest, you get to go first.
I have a feeling we're going to probably be a little bit different on this.
Most likely.
But my love for all the Van Damme films and seeing this for the first time in 25 to 30 years, there is some badness, unfortunately, that I have to acknowledge. But some things I really liked. I'd probably go maybe in the 6.5 area.
Ooh, okay. Maybe.
And I think that I might be being a little critical, but because of some of the stuff we've discussed throughout here. But I really like the action, and I'd say 6.5.
Nice. You've seen this. Oh, yeah, I've seen it years ago, but it's been a while for you. What do you say?
Well, I have to admit, I didn't hate it as much as I did when I first saw it 33 years ago. When I saw it back then, it just drove me nuts. It was like, oh my God, this is just a typical, you know, Reagan's era crap fest. But, you know, now that I've seen it now, and I got, especially the interview afterwards, that was really cool. This isn't quite as stinky. It's still pretty damn stinky. I'm still going to give it an 8.
You're going to give it an 8?
But I would have given it a 9 or higher, you know, had I just gone by memory.
Okay. So. Well, it's down to me.
Down to you.
And it's kind of funny, because I was going to go with a 6.
Wow.
So it's going to be close to what you gave, and it's actually lower than what you gave. And the reason, and I thought about this as I was walking my dog outside, and I was trying to think of what could I give this. It was actually a tie between 6 or 7 in a way. So it was kind of, you know, a thought about 6.5, but I thought it's still a 6. It's not a terrible movie. It is not by any means, like, I mean, people can watch this and enjoy it. I mean, I could show it to like my dad. I think he'd love it because he loves sports movies, you know, and stuff like that. Yeah, there's cheesy lines, there's cheesy whatever, but that's 80s for you. That's like, you know, every movie. Even Karate Kid had cheesy lines and stuff in it too, you know?
Well, I probably would have given this a 7, but I'm sorry, that breakdancing scene, it triggered me. It was awful. I had to live through that time period, and it was just too much. So that got a whole point in and of itself.
It was awful. Well, you know, you can't please everyone, I guess.
There you go.
The breakdancing scene was pretty bad, but then again, we did have Jean-Claude Van Damme in, and he was in Breaking 2, so you know, or whatever, as an extra or something, you know.
Yeah, it's just something about a crowd and a spectator in this, which I did not know that. And I've probably seen, God knows, a number of his films. He's done like 70 films, 50 of them like features, and
Seen Breaking 2?
I saw it as a kid, so I'm sort of in the same boat that you were probably in talking about this one. So seeing it now, I've seen it on TV a few times, like clips of it here and there, but I have no idea where he's at.
Pretty embarrassing.
And I don't remember thinking too much of it.
It's probably one of Cannon's most, like, you know, recognizable movies, but it's also one of Cannon's, like, worst movies that they ever did.
Now, had Jean-Claude Van Damme broken out in a fight with the electric, with the Boogaloo Shrimp and break into, that would have been cool.
Now, that would have been awesome.
Yes. Yeah, so that's one of Cannon's higher films, I guess. I'm thinking Cannon. I'm thinking of, like, what was it, American Ninja?
American Ninja.
I guess to sort of put this in an 80s scope, I guess this to me is a sort of in between Gymkhana and Karate Kid, leaning a lot more towards the Gymkhana side.
Yeah, it had some Rocky IV going on. So, I mean, it took a lot of stuff that was out there in the music. I mean,
Oh, my goodness.
Well, it was very Rocky / Karate Kid.
Yeah, on a keytar. Definitely an 80s keytar.
Yeah, like Paul said earlier, is like expecting Survivor rip-off type of song any minute.
Noriichi No Surrender song, which the title song was pretty good. The rest of the music was very Bill Conti score, you know, type thing. I don't know who did the score, but it was very much like, you know, Karate Kid and stuff with the music.
But so. I have to admit, now that I've seen it again 33 years later, I do like it better than when I first saw it. I hated it the first time I saw it.
It's funny. It's like I guess I respect it more, you know, because of what they tried to do. But when I was a kid, I mean, I just liked it because it was fun and I was into karate. I did karate, and so watching this movie always kind of hyped me up and made me want to practice my katas. So there you go.
So you were the Karate Kid.
I literally became it because I watched the Karate Kid. Like,
wow.
Yeah, I was like, Dad, Mom, that's what I want to do. You know, because my parents were trying to find me a sport to play. So they found me soccer, right? And I started doing soccer, and I hated it. I was bored, you know. I didn't like kicking a ball into a goal. Like, I felt like that was... So I spent the whole time talking with my friend instead of,
you know,
doing stuff. And then I got into karate, and karate became my thing.
And like this movie had, you could probably continue playing those montages of them repeatedly back in through your mind for how you were as a child.
Because
they have those 80s montages and stuff like that. You gotta love them.
Well, no wonder you're a supernatural assassin then, if you know all these fancy martial arts.
I guess, but then I tried doing it years later as an adult, and good God, I am out of shape. So it didn't really work out. I became a white belt again. I had to be start over as a white belt again. And
wow.
I was like, this sucks. I don't like it. So I did not. As an adult, I don't like doing karate, but as much. But from what the interview said, Kurt still does karate, still does martial arts.
Sure.
He doesn't practice in a dojo or anything, but does still practice his moves and keeps himself going. And it's definitely, and that's the one thing I really liked about this movie, was it was definitely an inspiration for people who want to go out and take care of bullies and you know, and become, you know, just better themselves.
Yeah, become something better.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely an inspiration. Like this and that movie Sidekicks and that and Karate Kid and stuff like that. Magic Kid, which I talked about with you guys earlier. Those movies are about, you know, finding yourself and everything and becoming a better person, you know, through the martial arts and stuff. And I kind of feel like they should make not remake Noriichi No Surrender, not remake Karate Kid again for like the 10th time, but like do a completely different movie that inspires people to go into martial arts, because there just hasn't been any. Only the Strong is another one I love.
I remember
to death.
That. Yeah, that was like it was mid
93.
Yeah.
And I actually I love Mark Dacascos, who's still doing stuff. He's like in the new John Wick movie. And, you know, he's just, that movie was a very big inspiration. And so was this movie for me. So a lot of people would get inspired by these things and go into the martial arts. And so I think this movie is actually really cool for that, you know, for that 80s thing. I was pleasantly surprised because I hadn't really rewatched this since I saw this Riff Tracks thing, and just having them make fun of it the whole time was harsh. You know, I was like, oh my God, I don't remember it being
I
that
haven't
bad.
Seen the Riff Tracks movie.
Oh God, you gotta, now that you've seen this again,
yeah,
you gotta,
yeah, yeah,
gotta
yeah,
watch that, because
yeah,
you'll laugh your butt off. They do really tear it a new asshole.
Nice.
But it kind of deserves that in a way, because it could have been so much better, and it wasn't.
Well, maybe we can shoot Karate Cow, and we can inspire the next generation.
Maybe. Well, on that note, Karate Cow. That sounds like a great animated movie. So with that being said, thank you guys so much for checking this out. Check us out on indiefilmcafe.reviews. Check us out on YouTube for Indie Film Cafe, on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon at Indie Film Cafe. You Google Indie Film Cafe, and I guarantee you every single thing will pop up.
On iTunes and Podbean and Stitcher.
Stitcher and Radio Public.
Radio Public.
All those different places you can find us. We're everywhere, man.
We're everywhere.
Good, because we pay to be everywhere.
There you go. Know?
So thank you guys so much. Also, I guess keep tuning in with the YouTube channels. We've got a ton of YouTube channels. So go to sickflickproductions.com. You'll see all the podcasts and the vidcasts. It'll be under series. You can find the Blu-ray Hunter, as well as Criterion Watch, as well as
Film Freaks.
Film Freaks TV, which Joe was just a part of. It got released this a couple Fridays ago, because this will be released next week, you know. And then let's see, what else do we got? Well, thank you, Joe. Also, thank you for coming back.
It was great being here. I'm a little bit stinkier of a movie than the last time, but still, it was not, it's not, from what I've been listening on some of these other ones, it's nowhere near any of those.
Yeah, we'll get you here on a really bad stinker. Yeah.
You'll
have
to be on one of his.
Well, I visited on a what the fuck Friday. I was blessed with what I got to see there.
Magic Lizard!
Magic Lizard. That was great.
But it was offset with a great Film Freaks TV.
So yeah, so we got to watch The Fog after watching Magic Lizard. Oh, my God. So, yeah. So
all right, guys.
We appreciate you guys listening to us ramble on about this silly, silly movie. And Continuity Monkey has one last thing to say.
Yep.